Good morning and welcome to Policy for Breakfast. An old friend and mentor of mine used to say that culture eats policy for breakfast. There is only so much we can do to change the cultural climate in the country. However, we can educate ourselves on the latest policy trends and analysis. We can educate ourselves so we will be able to make smart decisions for our future. This is a podcast to share open source policy papers. We want you to think big about how the world works and how we can change it for the better. And now the paper. The Third Rail Part 2. The Red Line. Back in the early 70s, long before she had helped block moving to Opportunity, Barbara Mikulski had made her name in Baltimore politics as a neighborhood activist leading the fight against one of the proposed new highways, a link between Interstate 95, which crosses just south of the city on an east-west axis, and Interstate 83, the expressway that enters town from the north. The link would have cut straight through historic Fells Point and Canton, on the waterfront just beyond. These neighborhoods were mostly white, and, unlike the I-70 link, this highway was blocked before any demolitions. 21. By the first decade of this century, these southeast Baltimore districts that had been spared were the locus of a remarkable rebirth. Redevelopment had spread beyond the inner harbor. The narrow neck of the harbor was now bracketed by a wall of Ritz-Carlton condos on one side and, on the other, by Harbor East, a growing cluster of high-rise hotels and upscale office buildings. The old white working-class neighborhoods spreading up from the docks, Canton and Locust Point, with their intact blocks of 19th-century raw houses, were being populated by urban professionals. There was even a new world-famous sports clothing company, Under Armour, that set up its headquarters in the old Tide detergent plant down along the water. All this upmarket real estate redevelopment was heartening, though any full accounting of the history has to come with an asterisk. It was all made possible by considerable public funding going all the way back to the quasi-public corporations and tax credits first established in the 70s by William Donald Schaefer, the city's eccentric, boosterish mayor, and then used to spur the Inner Harbor and other downtown projects, including the National Aquarium and the Convention Center. 22. Not only were the gleaming new buildings, largely focused on stimulating tourism, not doing much to benefit those in nearby West and East Baltimore, the subsidized projects were, quite literally, capitalizing on their struggles. Their private sector developers were qualifying for tax breaks from the city on the grounds that things were so bleak so close by that the only way these new projects could succeed was with public subsidy. The men who ran the Baltimore Development Corporation had a phrase for it, the Baltimore arithmetic. Nonetheless, as the neighborhoods prospered, the arrival of Whole Foods in Harbor East seemed to put an exclamation point on the revival. They helped give new life to the prospect of the old Third Rail line. No longer was the line merely a link for impoverished West Baltimore, its eastern stretch would run through the most active and gentrifying frontier in the city, especially if it was directed on a more southeasterly route, closer to the waterfront. This potential helped generate support for the line among the city's business establishment, which, stodgy as it might be, recognized that the rising cities that Baltimore aspired to be grouped with, places like Denver and Minneapolis, were building rail lines for the millennials who actually seemed to prefer transit riding to car commuting. Fueled by this ferment, the Third Line finally got moving. In 2002, Governor Paris Glendinning, a Democrat from the Washington suburbs who was enamored of smart growth urbanism, gave the nod to get the East-West Line built. After exhaustive study, a plan was eventually developed for a 14-mile route from the Social Security offices in the west to Hopkins Bayview in the east. As with the second line, the north-south one, the third line would be light rail, to cut costs. But to avoid the creep through downtown that slowed that earlier line, the new one would incorporate a 3.4-mile tunnel. It would be called the Red Line. The $2.9 billion plan, far from perfect, for one thing, to transfer from the new line to the Metro line downtown, one would need to walk a long tunnel. But the Red Line would at last provide a real conduit from the heart of West Baltimore to downtown and the jobs centers at both ends of the line, something more reliable than the number 15 bus that Raymond McCall had ridden all those years. Well below half the households in the corridor lacked a vehicle, which was why 4 of the 10 busiest bus lines ran along this stretch, and why several of these neighborhoods had the longest commute times in the city. The new line would give an incentive to developers to invest in the West Side neighborhoods close to the planned stations. And it would redeem the debacle of the Highway to Nowhere, the notorious West Side swath of eviction that had begun years before with the Harlem Park demolitions. The Red Line would finally make productive use of this right-of-way, give it purpose. At first there was some wariness in the West Side community. Fiascos like the Highway to Nowhere had left a legacy of distrust. But, over the aughts, the project's boosters, a mix of planners, engineers, and advocates who'd been working for years to make Baltimore Transit not just a couple of lines but actually a system, held countless meetings along the route and even sent dozens of community members around the country to study similar light rail lines. There was some resistance, too, in ever more gentrified Canton, among the neighborhood old-timers and the empty nesters who'd moved back into the city, and who, in an echo of the suburbs' fear of the loot trail, fretted about making their increasingly tony neighborhood that much more accessible. But many of the new arrivals, especially the younger ones, saw the new line for the progress it represented. Brooke Clearman, a Washington-area native who'd moved to Baltimore to clerk for a federal judge, had decided with her husband to remain in Fells Point precisely because it would be getting rail. "We lived in cities that were more transit-friendly," she said. "We were very excited at the prospect of living in a neighborhood that had a station." 23 She joined the advisory committees not only for her station area but also for the whole line. Imperfections aside, the project was solid enough to qualify for $900 million in scarce federal funding. The state raised its gas tax to cover its share of the cost, and also pay for a light rail line in the Washington suburbs, the Purple Line, that had been thrown in with the Red Line to build support with D.C. area legislators. Developers were snatching up parcels near Red Line stations, sites that hadn't garnered interest in decades. Contractors were readying to bid on a project that would put thousands to work. Still, over the decade, the process began to drag out. Glendening's successor, Republican Robert Ehrlich, who took office in 2003, did little to advance things during his 4 years as governor. His successor, the Democratic former mayor of Baltimore, Martin O'Malley, was more supportive, but over his 2 terms he didn't act with much urgency. As much as he championed his city, he'd never focused closely on its inadequate public transit, and the NIMBY resistance to the line in Canton had given him pause. 24 With his tenure coming to a close, O'Malley was planning on handing the project off to his anointed successor, Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown. After $288 million worth of planning and design, construction was set to begin in 2015. The country roads. Best laid plans. For even as Baltimore was showing signs of comeback, in addition to the waterfront development, the homicide rate was falling and population loss was leveling off. The old wariness had lingered in the suburbs, the suspicion that the troubled city was getting more than its share, paid for by the tax increases of the O'Malley years. The perception was at odds with reality. The city's legislative delegation had shrunk by half since the 1970s, from 44 to 22, as the state's political weight shifted toward the growing D.C. suburbs, but the resentment persisted nonetheless, and, in 2014, it got its vehicle. The Republican nominee challenging Anthony Brown was a commercial real estate broker from Anne Arundel County by the name of Larry Hogan. Burly and affable, Hogan was an everyman figure, and not overly ideological. But he deftly tapped into a well of regional resentment toward Baltimore. He was the man for the outlying areas. He made plain his scorn for costly investments in the city, including the Red Line. "We're going to focus on building roads," he said. Somehow, Hogan's campaign didn't set off alarms in the city. It didn't help that Brown himself, from the Washington suburbs, showed relatively little interest in Baltimore and was not exactly rallying voters with his lackluster campaign. 25 But it was also striking how little the city's own leaders, from Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake on down, were doing to make the stakes plain to residents, especially when it came to its biggest infrastructure project in decades. On November 4, 2014, Hogan won by 6 percentage points, aided not just by big margins in the Baltimore suburbs, including Baltimore County, the state's bellwether, but also by the startlingly anemic turnout in the city. The cost of this apathy soon became all too plain. 1 month after the election, Hogan declared that he viewed Baltimore as a failed city. What has been happening, taxing and spending and pouring millions into the city, has not helped. It has really hurt, Hogan told the Sunday. There's no businesses, there's no jobs. The city's declining rather than improving. Upon taking office, Hogan cut $36 million from the city's schools. 26. 3 months into his tenure, Baltimore exploded when Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old who grew up around the Gilmer homes on the west side, was arrested for running from the police and allegedly carrying a switchblade, and died 6 days later of spinal injuries suffered in police custody. 27. The riot that followed Gray's death was far less destructive than the 3 days of rioting that followed King's death in 1968. For one thing, nobody died, but it was enough to draw the cable news anchor stars, and to prompt countless meditations on inner city failure, and, because this was Baltimore, endless invocations of the wire. Many cast Baltimore as a sort of freak anomaly, a third world city that had broken loose from another continent and floated up the Chesapeake Bay. In fact, it was not. Inequality, the income ratio between rich and poor, was barely higher than the norm for American cities, partly because the wealthiest residents in Baltimore were nowhere near the stratospheric heights of their counterparts in richer cities like Washington. The city was less segregated by class than many others, thanks in part to the remnants of its white working class. And even as segregated as it was by race, in this, too, it lagged many other cities. As stark as the region's black-white disparities were, the area's median income for black households was the second highest in the country, after Washington, thanks partly to those growing middle-class black suburbs. 28. But there was one ranking in which Baltimore did stand out. Exactly 1 week after the riot, Harvard researchers Raj Chetty and Nathaniel Hinderin released a high-profile nationwide study showing what a large impact a child's environment had on his or her future earnings. The city that was found to have the very worst impact on poor kids' future opportunity was Baltimore, especially when it came to boys. 29. Here, just days after the riot, was social science affirmation of what news viewers were seeing displayed, the consequences of the social isolation in the city's poor neighborhoods. It was precisely to reduce isolation and, quite literally, to improve mobility that transit boosters had rallied behind the Red Line. Indeed, Chetty and Hinderin also found strong correlation between length of commute and economic mobility. Which was why it was such a blow to the civic solar plexus when Larry Hogan announced, in late June, 2 months after the riots, that he was pulling the plug on the project. Hogan had made gestures of concern for West Baltimore after the violence, setting up a temporary office there and walking the streets. But there would be no post-riot epiphany to trump his underlying anti-urban bias. He would fund the new Purple Line in suburban Washington, icing on the cake for a metro system now light years ahead of Baltimore's, further widening the regional inequality between the two cities, but he would forfeit the $900 million in federal funding for the Red Line, write off the $288 million the state had spent as a loss, and redirect $736 million of the additional state money allocated for it to roads in exurbs and rural counties. By way of rationale, Hogan dismissed the Red Line as a wasteful boondoggle, and the downtown tunnel, in particular, as a costly indulgence, as if it was outlandish for rail lines and cities to run underground. Soon afterward, it would emerge in public records requests from a pro-transit group that his administration had given the Question Zero study. In the absence of a regional transportation authority to provide continuity from one administration to another, a new governor could simply toss away a project on which previous administrations had spent nearly $300 million. And he could do so without risking much ire from a city that had grown to expect so little in the way of high-quality public transportation. Which helps explain why even when the project was on the verge of construction, the Red Line seemed somehow not quite real. Those who would depend upon the new line were, after all, among the city's most disenfranchised and least politically engaged, whereas in hyper-engaged quarters like Roland Park, it was a remote irrelevance. Not to mention that Hogan had gotten little apparent pressure from local elected officials and business leaders in the months prior to the decision. The city's power brokers had supported the project, but not enough to go to war over it. They were not the ones standing at dawn at the Edmondson Avenue bus stop. The decision did land heavily for at least one elected official. Brooke Clearman, the young lawyers who'd moved to Fells Point, had been elected to the state legislature in 2014. She had remained involved in the Red Line planning groups, and she was out of town at a conference when she learned of the rejection. She rushed to the rest room, fearing she'd get sick. "I was nauseous and sick not only because of all the hours and nights and weekends and years people had put into the project to make it the best it could be for the city, but also because it had seemed like a project that could unite Baltimore, by providing jobs and linking neighborhoods," she said later in an interview. "And especially after the unrest in April, to have that taken away from us felt like an almost insurmountable blow." But clearly the unrest had not moved Hogan. Others, too, were heedless of the link. The Washington Post, for example, had called for more investment in Baltimore and access to jobs after the riot, but it applauded the rejection of the Red Line, saying it never made transportation or financial sense. Hogan did in fact link the riot with his decision, but only to justify it. "We just spent $14 million extra money on the riots in Baltimore City a few weeks ago," he said, as if the city could only expect so much support, and had foolishly blown it on a riot. 3 weeks later, his administration released a revealing map showing how the money for road upgrades would be allocated around the state. Not only did the governor's map show no money for Baltimore City, it did not show the city at all. By some Freudian slip, the city of 620,000 people had mistakenly been swallowed up by the Chesapeake Bay. Disappeared. The lawsuit. Any fallout Hogan might have risked from his decision was quickly overshadowed by the events of the city's terrible summer of 2015. 41 people were killed in May, the month after the riot, more homicides than the city had seen in a month in a quarter century. In July trumped even that, with 45, tying a mark set in 1972, when the city had 275,000 more people. Many in town attributed the spike to the fact that the police had by their own admission pulled back after the riot, aggrieved over the charges against their colleagues in the Freddie Gray case and their superiors' handling of the riot. Raymel McCall had a different perspective. He'd left Baltimore after college for divinity school and ordination as an Episcopal priest. He had then come back home, where he was assigned the ministry at the Church of St. Michael and All Angels, in the heart of the city. In an earlier time, the Big Stone Church had been home to the city's highest church Episcopalians, its WASP elite, but post-white flight the congregation had dwindled to a few dozen regulars, almost all black. On Sundays, they sat on only one side of the huge nave, to make attendance seem less sparse. From this vantage, Reverend McCall linked disregard for the city with a disregard for life within it. "People are dealing with distrust," he said. "It only makes sense for people to say, no one really cares, so why should I care?" With the city fixated on the violence, the mourning over the Red Line carried on quietly among the clutch of people who had spent years working to make it happen. "It's devastating," said Matt Gallagher, O'Malley's chief of staff in Baltimore and Annapolis, in an interview. "There was already $300 million worth of activity in the pipeline, and it's just been sucked out." He fumed at the reappropriation of gas tax revenues, and at Hogan's claim that the project's fatal flaw was its downtown tunnel. "It's absurd, like that's some big revelation, they need a tunnel. It betrays a superficial understanding of how these things work." Gallagher had a simple explanation. "They don't care," he said. 30. Elijah Cummings, the Democratic congressman from Baltimore who had helped secure the $900 million in federal funding, couldn't believe Hogan had given it back. "We're talking about thousands of jobs," he said. "It would have helped a lot of small businesses. But more importantly, it would have helped people get to work." He was also thinking of all the people in the neighborhoods along the line who had gotten involved in the planning. "It was devastating for people trying to have faith in government," he said. A lot of these people had never spoken to each other before they started working on the line. They became friends, they worked it out. The next thing you know, he trailed off. They don't understand. 31. In September, some of those people gathered for a sort of Irish wake for the Red Line. Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz, a Democrat, said its backers had failed to build support in the suburbs, the implication being that this might have made it palatable to Hogan. Their politics aren't in Baltimore City, he said. Cynthia Shaw, an elderly woman from Edmondson Village, asked about the upgrades that her community group had devised for the area around the plan station. What happens to the trees we were planning, the other designs? Who do we talk to? And Richard Chambers, a local transit activist, rose to demand why the cancellation of such a major project wasn't being challenged from a civil rights perspective. He pointed out that the state legislature had voted on an increase in the gas tax with the understanding that it would be used for a transit project to benefit low-income minorities in Baltimore. Instead, the money was now being entirely redirected to road projects in wealthier, mostly white outlying areas. It's almost unprecedented, he said. This is a fuck you to Baltimore. As it happened, an unusual court challenge to Hogan's decision, under Title V of the Civil Rights Act, was being contemplated by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which was now being led by Sherilyn Afeel, the law professor who had watched the mothers waiting at the bus stops in West Baltimore 2 decades ago. Afeel saw the issue through an historical lens. In mid-century, she said, Maryland taxpayers, including Baltimore's blacks, had paid for highways that were used primarily by whites who'd moved out of the city. Even today, state money went to public infrastructure like the new Outer Beltway for suburban Washington that opened in 2011, 32 or upgrades for the highway that took affluent families to hotels and beachfront properties on the Eastern Shore. Do you think women from West Baltimore are going to a St. Eve to lay on the beach? Afeel said. We're a state. Being a state means there is a give and take. Sometimes you give, sometimes you take. As Afeel had seen years ago, when she arrived in Edmondson Village, the poor public transportation system had long exacerbated segregation and the concentration of poverty in Baltimore, and building the Red Line would have been a step toward alleviating that, not just by making it easier to get to jobs but by opening up neighborhoods to people on both sides of the color line. What's more, the Supreme Court had, in 2015, reaffirm disparate impact, the theory that actions can be judged discriminatory if they adversely affect a particular group, as a legal measure of discrimination, and killing the Red Line was a prime example. Transportation is not sexy, Afeel said. I understand why people don't pay attention to this. But these are decisions about what we as a community will look like 20 or 30 years from now. 4 days before Christmas, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the American Civil Liberties Union filed a Title V complaint with the U.S. Department of Transportation, alleging that the killing of the Red Line was only the latest in the state's long historical pattern of deprioritizing the needs of Baltimore's primarily African American population. The complaint used the state's own economic estimates to show how racially disparate the impact of the funding shift would be, a naked transfer of resources from blacks to whites. On one level, the complaint sought to secure more funds for Baltimore Transit, even if it was too late to save the Red Line. But on a deeper level, it was a demand for reckoning. After the Red Line was canceled, there were no protests in the street, there was very little media attention, and there was very little effort to connect the decision of the governor with what we had seen several months earlier, in the riot, said Afeel, in announcing the lawsuit. As much attention as we give to the trials of the officers who are charged with killing Freddie Gray, we should give to a decision that implicates 10,000 construction jobs and billions of dollars of infrastructure investment in Baltimore that were eliminated in a single day by a single decision made by a single person. 33. In early 2015, Amazon opened a fulfillment center off Browning Highway on the former site of a General Motors plant on the southeastern edge of town. Sprawling over 1 million square feet, surrounded by an immense, 1,900-space parking lot, the boxy building with blank walls resembles a gigantic minimum security prison. For decades, thousands of men and women earned good wages, $27 per hour, give or take, assembling Chevy Astros and GMC Safaris at the automobile factory. Now, they started at $13, sorting and packing an infinitude of consumer goods made in countries where labor costs were even cheaper. The warehouse had about 3,000 employees by the time of the official grand opening in September. Local leaders, who had provided Amazon $40 million in tax incentives to locate the warehouse in Baltimore, rose to talk about how much Amazon had improved their lives. "I don't have to take off my sweats to get deodorant anymore," said Congressman Dutch Ruppersberger, from Baltimore County. "You're very trustworthy for making sure my moisturizer gets to me on time," said Mayor Rawlings Blake. Inside the cavernous main hall, squat orange robots buzzed around with tall stacks of bins from which workers assembled shoppers' orders. Weight loss supplements, basketballs, Listerine, power drills, spinning poppers, a steam spray mop, bakeware sets, smarter rest foam pillows, raw unfiltered honey, rodent repellent, baby Joerns. Once wrapped and stamped, the packages were zipped along a conveyor belt until they reached the truck headed their way, at which point a small weight would slide across the belt and punch the package off. 100 per minute, 6,000 per hour. Far less efficient was the scene outside the building at shift change. The Red Line, the routes of which had been planned before Amazon announced its plans in 2014, would have brought workers to under 2 miles from the warehouse. This was hardly ideal, and indeed, the original 1968 vision for the line would have brought employees all the way to the site, but it was close enough to run constant shuttles and to contemplate an eventual extension. But of course there would be no Red Line, and the only compensation that Hogan finally offered was a sketchy plan to create a dozen high-frequency city bus lines by late 2017, with little detail about how the new routes would navigate through an already clogged downtown. Transit advocates like Brooke Learman and Richard Chambers pointed out the plan's inadequacy as a substitute, but by now the travails of Baltimore Transit were not registering outside the city, not in the county, not in the state. 34 Hogan was enjoying high approval ratings, and in January he even managed to give the impression of rebuilding some goodwill in the city when he announced $70 million to speed demolitions of thousands of vacant homes. There would be no money for constructing a rail line through West Baltimore, but there'd be money for tearing down many of its blocks. Meanwhile, Amazon was struggling to get people to work on time. It didn't matter that these employees were working at one of the most cutting-edge companies in the world, they were still slogging through the same long commutes that the city's working class had faced forever. Those workers with cars encountered horrific traffic jams snaking to the lone warehouse entrance. The MTA added a new bus line to the area, the number 26, but it quickly became overloaded. So Amazon started running shuttle buses along the 5-mile route to downtown. With the public realm having failed to provide this basic function of governance, the private sector was filling the void, while still seeking public subsidy. In December, it emerged that Amazon, with a market capitalization of more than $300 billion, had received a forgivable $100,000 loan from the Baltimore Development Corporation to help cover the cost of the shuttle. But as it's turned out, even that stopgap isn't working. On one recent Friday evening, there was total chaos in the huge parking lot. The line of cars arriving for the night shift was backed way up. Cars trying to leave were jammed up just as badly in the lot. "This is all bullshit," one angry worker shouted through his car window. The backup meant that the shuttles were running behind, as was the 26 bus. Among those waiting in the dark chill was a worker in his 40s, a military veteran who'd been glad to get the $13 per hour job but was more and more worn down by the amount of time spent commuting to and from his home in West Baltimore. For a while he'd been taking the Amazon shuttles but had gotten fed up with how the drivers treated the workers, pulling up at unpredictable spots, making them chase after them. "They shouldn't be playing games," he said. "Especially with all the hours of work, people's feet are hurting." So he'd switched to the city bus instead, even if it meant an excruciating stop-and-go ride through southeast Baltimore. The night before, he had not gotten home until 8:30, 2.5 hours after the end of his shift. But he had dinner leftovers ready from the night before. And it still beat being jerked around by the company shuttle. On this Friday night, he waited 30 minutes before the 26 bus finally pulled up. Thank God it wasn't cold, real, real cold, he said, and climbed on board. The bus swayed past the half-demolished hulk of the Sun Products detergent factory, past the strip joints where the GM workers used to congregate, around Greektown, past the bus facility where Reverend McCall's mother used to report to work. One passenger pulled out a 40 of malt liquor and poured some out for his friend in a plastic cup. The bus creaked through the newly Hispanic area north of Canton and Fells Point, past a small shopping strip in the no man's land just south of Hopkins Hospital, liquor, nails. In the distance, the new towers around the harbor loomed into view, the Legg Mason headquarters, the Marriott, the Four Seasons. And every 10 minutes, an automated recording would come on the intercom, telling riders about the governor's exciting new bus plan. The MTA recently announced a comprehensive plan to transform the Baltimore transit system. When fully implemented in the summer of 2017, it will create the comprehensive transit system that Baltimore citizens expect and deserve. The bus finally arrived at its downtown destination at 7:30, an hour and a half after the workers had gotten out of the warehouse. It had taken 50 minutes to cover 5 miles. The veteran hustled off to catch the next leg, with 5 more miles to go. This concludes rest of the paper. The original can be found in places. Thank you for listening to Policy for Breakfast, a podcast produced by Cognitive Dissidents. If you have a paper to share, please connect with us on Twitter at CogDissidents. That's at CogDissidents. Subscribe to ensure you hear the next paper, posted every Monday.